Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today I asked Peter, what is our theme? And he said, I think it's we don't have a theme.
we just have three excellent contributions to the world of food literature. And an outstanding one to start off today's program.
We have Julia Tershin. And she's done a great cookbook called Small Victories, which will give you a lot of courage and direction in the kitchen.
And you'll just enjoy reading the recipes anyway because they're fun.
They are fun. I'll bet if you looked at most of the cookbooks on your shelf, you'd find that Julia Tershin was the writer of most of them. And finally, she's written one all by herself. Small Victories, and it's subtitled Recipes, Advice, and Hundreds of Ideas for Home Cooking Triumphs. Welcome, Julia. And Peter was leafing through this cookbook, and he said, boy, she really knows what she's talking about. And I said, she should, after all those cookbooks.
Yeah, I mean, some of the recipes have three or four victories all in one paragraph.
Maybe you should just explain what you mean by small victories.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a delight to get to talk to you guys about the book. So the premise of Small Victories is just that. It's about identifying the small victories in the kitchen and stopping to pause and celebrate them and realizing that when you learn them, you're on your way to becoming a really confident home cook. And so the small victories range from, simple, just straightforward techniques like how to get seeds out of a pomegranate to kind of cerebral things like maybe just coming up with a new name for a dish so that it's a little bit more exciting, things like that. So every recipe is introduced with a small victory, and as you mentioned, some of them have more than one small victory, and it's all the tips and techniques I've learned along the way from working on other books to working for a long time as a private chef and for being a lifelong home cook.
Yeah, well, you do know your way around the kitchen. I must say I was very impressed with this book. You have so much common sense in it, and also intelligent, and it's funny. You're funny.
Thank you so much.
Now,
I'm so happy to hear that.
Julie, you never actually worked in a professional kitchen, then?
No, I've spent a lot of time in them because I've worked on a number of restaurant cookbooks, but no, I've never cooked in a restaurant kitchen. But I did work for a long time as a private chef.
Sure.
Garlic in the basement.
Now, the interesting thing is, we've had this conversation before with chefs, and the challenge of creating a recipe that you can cook at home. When you cook it in a restaurant, you probably have four or five different pairs of hands involved in the preparation, and then when you take that home, how are you going to do that? you don't have sous chefs and commis chefs and people doing, even people washing the dishes beside you. So you have to make them a bit simpler.
Absolutely. And I think all of the work I do, I'm definitely keeping the home cook in mind because that's exactly what I am. And I'm always trying to look for the simplest route to making something really great. And I always try to keep the number of dishes in mind because until about 2 years ago, I always lived in studio apartments but never had dishwashers.
It
was very clear to me that, if something called for two bowls but you really could get away with using one, I'm always going to use the one. I'll never tell you to use something you don't need.
Yeah, you lay out you start with some things to keep in mind. And I love this theory. I'm seeing it in more and more cookbooks that you only need three knives. Not everybody says the same exact three, but they're all pretty much the same.
Yeah, I definitely think less is more. And when it comes to knives, I don't think anyone needs that whole set. There's a lot of knives that come, in those big, when you get the whole set, like the whole block of them, that I don't really know what they're for.
I know. we bought our son knives, Wusthof set, for when he got married. And I don't think he's ever sharpened them. And the whole time he's had them, like 10 years ago or 11 years ago, I guess.
Well, we get things like that. You remember the left-handed bread knife we got?
Oh, yeah. What did we do with it?
We gave it to my sister.
She's left-handed.
Having a left-handed bread knife was absolutely no good to either one of us. since about all we can do with our left hand is pick our noses.
Well, you know, I can't even imagine all these people dreaming up these projects and these kitchen gadget manufacturers or producers. The stuff we get to the kitchen, I mean, I don't know how many recipes and cookbooks that I've now encountered for spiralizing. Why do you have to spiralize anything?
And on the subject of knives, you remember those knives made in Australia?
Oh, yeah.
We got one and we
Rachel
liked it.
Ray.
And then, well, no, Rachel Ray picked it up after that with an orange handle.
Yeah, we have one of those, actually.
Yeah, I know. I keep on wanting to give it to my brother, and you say, no, we're keeping it, and I don't know what we're keeping it for.
I don't know. We always give your brother everything.
It's never been out of the desk. It's never been out of the drawer in the cupboard.
Maybe that one you can use to open packages.
Well, that and my other favorite, I just went through with another author about the time we got an avocado pitter in the mail.
An avocado pitter? What does that even look like?
Well, I mean, it's this thing on a handle with a big loop that's sharp. And the idea was not clear because we used it. And we put it in one end of the avocado and pressed it down. And it sliced through, taken out almost all the avocado. And it left this core that was totally useless.
Well, it took a plug of avocado out from the center of the avocado and shot it onto the wall adjacent.
Yeah, in the studio. But, I mean, the rep of this manufacturer said, well, no, you have to cut the avocado in half anyhow to start with. I said, well, what's this for? And that's for removing the pit. Now, what is hard about removing an avocado pit?
It's probably a small victory.
Yeah, absolutely.
See, we had a small victory. We actually managed to get the avocado pitter through the hole of the avocado.
So, but anyhow, this itself is good information about some things to keep in mind and what you need. And then you go through about these ingredients. Most of your ingredients are, you can get them anywhere and they're not exotic or anything. But any one that is, you explain right up front. Unusual ingredients.
Absolutely.
That's a good chapter.
Thank you. Yeah, no, it's very important to me that everything in the book is easy to make and is also easy to shop for. And some of the best feedback I've received about the book is that people have, you know, brought the book home and then realized that, you know, they didn't even have to go out to get anything. They already had most of what they needed to make whatever recipe they wanted. So I love hearing that.
Yeah.
And I believe so strongly in the accessibility of recipes, and I live in a really small, tiny country town, and my feeling is that if I can't find an ingredient, you know, within half an hour of my house,
I'm not
going to call for it in a recipe. Or if I do, I'll give you a really good reason why I think it's worth finding, but I'll also always give you, you know, things you can substitute if you can't track it down.
Well, I happen to have in my refrigerator this gochujang. But do many people
have it? Wow.
Oh, sure. But do many people have it?
Well, I think nowadays they do. It's a great Korean chili paste. But
I love
I'm delighted it's becoming more popular because it's a wonderful ingredient.
You can get it at Whole Foods. I think you can actually get it at Giant Eagle, too.
And the other thing, even though Peter's not real crazy about them, I always have preserved lemons in there.
Oh, I love them.
I do, too. I eat them out of the jar if you don't cook with them. So anyhow,
maybe on a night when he's out of town, you can use them.
Well, I eat them.
I don't leave nearly enough these days.
But you know, the recipes are straightforward, but they're also very inventive. I mean, that's an overused word, but you're somebody who really likes interesting flavors, aren't you?
Yeah, I always think of, it's interesting because I think the food in the book and the food I make in general is quite eclectic, and I like food from all around the world, but I think the thing that all of my recipes have in common is they're all simple recipes, but they're not afraid of big flavor, so I think your description's absolutely accurate.
I'm tired of reading about deviled eggs, but you have some really good, it's worth doing them. They're so tedious, aren't they, doing this deviled eggs? But the twists, like the spin-offs you call them, are delicious.
I'm so glad to hear that. Yeah, every single recipe in the book not only has the small victories that we talked about, those like tips and techniques, but every recipe also has variations, which I called spin-offs. And my reason for including them is just to show how fun you can have in the kitchen, how inventive it can be, and also how, you know, once you know the small victory, once you know the tip or technique, you can make the one main recipe, but you can also make so many other things. So there's a lot of bang for your buck for each recipe, and the eggs, the hard-boiled eggs that have a number of spin-offs, including all sorts of deviled eggs. That's one of my favorite things, and I agree they can be a little tedious to make. I like making them for just a small group, not a big group.
Yeah,
you're
right.
Not, you know, peeling forever.
wasn't that the one where you said, and if you don't want to do all this work, you can always just spread some mayo across the top of all of them and sprinkle some hot peppers on there.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
And you're done.
Yeah, now, and they're delicious.
The chicken soup one was the one that confused me.
Oh, yeah, Peter wants to know about this chicken soup.
Sure, yeah,
tell me. I don't
know
if you can find it.
Well, photo.
The first photo, which is a big four-page photo,
there it is.
Looked like it had some things in it that weren't
weren't
in the list of ingredients. Is it just onion skins? I mean, it's much darker.
Oh,
color.
In the picture of like the stock being made.
Yes.
Yeah, they're onion skins, and I think.
Oh, that's Scott. That's how you make stock. I see. Now I get.
Yeah. So that's the stock that then gets strained and becomes the chicken soup.
Oh, now I understand. I thought there must be a page error or something like that.
I see what you're saying. No, that makes a lot of sense.
So when you turn
when
you turn the page, you actually get much clearer what looks more like chicken soup with carrots and parsnips in it.
Yeah, that photo is a good example of why I actually love the people who I worked with to take the photos so much. They're this amazing husband and wife team, Andrea Gentle and Marty Hires.
Oh, they're great photos.
They're amazing. I love the photos, and I love the people who took them so much. And they're so good at finding like beauty in everything. And so, for example, when I was making the stock that was going to become the chicken soup, which was on the cover of the book, actually, it's just thinking about the final chicken soup, and I wanted it to be beautiful and, you know, look like what it is, which is my favorite food in the world. And as I was making it, they, you know, they basically pulled the pot off the stove, and they were like, well, this is just so beautiful at this point. And I was like, it's not done, you know. But then they were like, no, this is so beautiful. And I love that photo, and I think it's it's a great testament to how they kind of are always working with their eyes open, and they're always finding amazing moments in the kitchen.
Yeah, well, you really passed it. Chicken soup has to be, you know, well, I was just thinking that it's time we should have another big part of it. Peter's one of his specialties is chicken soup, but it's very particular, and you pass the test. You have dill, fresh dill, and parsnips.
Okay, I'm so glad I passed the test. That's great.
Yeah, if you can lay your hands on some celery root that doesn't require you to take out a second mortgage on your house.
That's helpful.
That's also very good.
In fact, yeah, that sounds great. I love celery root.
In fact, we also use rutabagas and turnips.
Yeah, rutabagas are becoming popular. I was rather surprised.
Where are you from, Peter?
I'm originally from England, and there we call them Swedes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love any kind of winter root vegetable.
Yeah, people get them mixed up with turnips, and they have nothing in common with turnips at all, do they?
Yeah, they're very different.
Let's ask you, because there's so many recipes that I like in this book. And brisket with apricots and prunes sounds heavenly. What are some of your all-time favorite recipes?
I think the one that we were just talking about, the chicken soup, is definitely one of my absolute favorites, and it's a recipe I learned from my Aunt Renee, who's sadly no longer with us, but it's a real family recipe, and it's really just classic Jewish chicken soup. And
well,
I feel like
that's the dill and the parsnips in there.
Exactly, yeah. And it's you know, it's a recipe that means so much to me, just sort of emotionally and personally, and I feel like every time I make it, I feel so connected to my family, and every time I eat it, I feel like it's this flavor I've known my whole life, and there's something so comforting about that. But then I think from just a cook's point of view, it's a wonderful recipe because I think you really learn just how simple something can transform, and you basically are turning water into the most magical elixir in the world just by letting it simmer for a long time. And I think there's something incredible about that, and I think it's sort of cooking 101. So I think it's a recipe. Yeah, it means a lot to me. I think it tells a story, but it's also just such a useful recipe. And I think if you know how to make a really basic chicken soup, you can make so many other things.
We have good friends that we dine with at our respective houses quite frequently, and the last time they came to us, we made chicken soup, didn't we?
Yeah, we made
chicken,
a big pile of it.
Made chicken soup for company.
I love that. I think making really, familiar, comforting foods when you have people over is such a wonderful thing to do, and sometimes it can be really unexpected, but I think, there's nothing like eating, home cooking in someone's home. I think that's the best.
Well, we had a New England boiled dinner. It was really corned beef and cabbage, And people went crazy over it. I mean, I never have thought of making that for company, but that
you
was
keep on
like,
you keep on wanting to me to reproduce that.
I know. I love it.
I got a piece of brisket that weighed like 7.5 pounds.
We ate it quite a long time.
And I filled the two largest stew pots we have. We had two stew pots full.
How many people did you have over?
Was it... Eight.
Six or eight, I can't remember which.
I think it was eight.
There was more than one pot left by the time we were done.
Yeah.
Now here's
to bring containers.
Here's an interesting one. Roasted radishes with Kalamata dressing. Now, what inspired that?
So that was inspired mostly because I love the fear. Sort of starting a meal and you're having drinks or something like that, and I think two things that people commonly put out are radishes and olives. I think olives are a really common thing to find served with cocktails and wine and that kind of thing, and crunchy radishes as well. And so that recipe is the roasted radishes, because I think radishes are undervalued as a vegetable that you can cook, and they're delicious when you roast them. They get kind of sweet and, like any other vegetable, a little bit caramelized. And to sort of offset that sweetness, I made just a really simple dressing that has chopped olives in it. And it's a wonderful combination, and it's a bit unexpected. And in addition to sort of that familiar pairing happening with drinks, it was also inspired by, I once had a job when I worked as a private chef cooking for a client who was completely vegan. And he didn't eat any processed food. So my list of what I could make was a little bit limited, but I kind of love when I'm given those boundaries as a cook, because I feel like I get to be really creative. Like if you tell me to make anything, sometimes I draw a blank, but if you tell me to, cook for someone who's, then it's, once I know sort of what the boundaries are, I can really kind of, I feel like just like explode with ideas within those boundaries. So when I cooked for him, I was making all different kinds of vegetables and just trying to make them, really different and unexpected, just to keep his meals exciting. And so one of the things I made for him were these roasted radishes, and they were a big hit, so I always kind of kept a mental note of them.
Now, did you keep and cook the radish greens?
I don't use them in that recipe, but I do use them often. I make like a kind of like a salsa verde with them, like chop them up with garlic and capers and olive oil, or I've added them to, a stir fry or a saute.
I'm the guy who gets to the radishes in the Whole Foods store and picks them all over to figure out which one has the best looking greens.
Yeah, because a lot of them are really. Everybody throws them out, so they don't really worry about putting out wilted greens on your radishes.
But if you go through the stack, you can frequently get a good discovery.
Yeah, and the ones with the
best
radishes.
Right. Tell us about this section, a few drinks and some things to keep on hand. I wasn't clear on what things to keep on hand.
Sure, that's the last section of recipes in the book, and it's sort of, I think of it as a little bit like the miscellaneous drawer.
Okay. And in our house, we call it the Red Bull.
Yeah, exactly. That's so funny. So, yeah, so there's some drinks, both, you know, alcoholic, like cocktails, but then also, you know, drinks that don't have alcohol. And then things to keep on hand were, in my mind, kind of pantry ingredients. So there's, you know, pickled onions and a vinaigrette and cilantro and scallion sauce that's really delicious on just about anything. So they're kind of almost like larder ingredients,
yeah.
Sauces and dips and stuff like that.
The cilantro and scallion sauce, you keep that?
Yeah, that's the kind of thing that I like to make, especially if I've, you know, bought cilantro to use in something and then have some extra and, you know, I don't want it to go bad. So I'll chop it up and make that sauce, and then it's delicious on anything, on a piece of grilled meat, on roast chicken.
Do you freeze it or what?
Sweet potatoes. You definitely can. I usually use it before, you know, I love it, so I eat it pretty quickly and put it on lots of things. But if you'd like, it definitely freeze as well. And I like to freeze stuff like that in an ice cube tray, and that was one
so
of the small victories.
I did it with mango. Would you believe mango?
Yeah, no, that's a great idea. Because then you don't have to defrost a whole big thing to get just a little bit.
Yeah, well, they had mangoes on sale, this whole big flat of them for $5 because they were all overripe. So I peeled them and I put them in ice cube trays.
That's so smart.
Yeah, and they were great. I loved them. So anyhow,
and then what do you do with it? You add them to like smoothies or?
No, I mean I just would. I make Peter fruit every morning. So frozen fruit, I just make the fruit the night before and it thaws by breakfast. So I do that with blueberries, raspberries. Ground cherries, and you know, if I get a deal on mangoes,
the best fruit of all is cherries.
And grapes freeze well.
The only problem is Anne gets upset with the cherry pitter.
Yeah, somebody should have invented a decent cherry pitter.
And the pile of cookbooks next to where she pops the cherries out gets covered in little spots of cherry juice.
Yeah. Oh, gets like splattered. Oh, like polka dots.
But the 12 hours between when she makes the fruit and when I eat it is just the perfect time for the cherries to thaw. And they are delicious, and it feels like summer all year round.
Yeah.
Sure, yeah.
Let me say one more thing, because I don't want to leave this out. Is you conclude this wonderful book with a section called Seven Lists, and they're lists of seven things to do, like seven easy but memorable bites to have with drinks. Seven things to do with a can of chickpeas. I mean, I love this section.
I'm so glad. Yeah, that section is definitely one of my favorites. And, yeah, it's seven different lists, and each list has seven items on it. So it's this, I think of it as like the bonus content, like the extra credit. And
I was going to say an extra benefit from the book is this section.
Yeah, I just I wanted to include sort of, because they're not formal recipes, they're kind of more just sort of like suggestions. And when I was writing it, my what I sort of kept in mind was I often get calls and emails from family and friends. My dad, for example, we're always talking about food, and sometimes he'll call me and say, like, I've got, you know, leftover salmon from last night, or leftover roast chicken, like, what should I do with it? And it was the way in which I respond to him that really inspired kind of how I wrote that section. So they're just sort of like encouraging easy ideas, and I really, my goal in the whole book is to just show that, you know, cooking doesn't have to be intimidating, and that you can be so creative and inventive when you're in the kitchen. So those lists, I think, are really useful, and I hope they'll also help people come up with their own ideas, you know, even beyond the list.
Julia, will you be my next best friend? Because I love you.
Sure.
You have a whole section also on giving back, which I think is just wonderful. Organizations that could use your help. I mean, you're so thoughtful. So anyhow.
Thank you so much.
Yes, well, I'm thrilled for you, and I hope you do really well with this book.
I really appreciate it. No, it's I just had such a wonderful time creating it, and it's been so exciting to get it out into the world, and I'm just glad people are enjoying cooking from it. It's a dream come true.
Oh, wow. You deserve it.
Thank you so much.
Good talking to you, Julia.
And to you. Thank you so much for having me.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back after a short break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Has anybody noticed that there's a certain renewed interest and intensity about breakfast these days? And we've gotten a number of cookbooks.
Most important meal of the day. Or whatever.
Well, they always say that. But, I mean, I still remember trying to struggle out of bed and get the lunches packed, and do the breakfast. And I'm never awake. I'm not a morning person. So we have this latest book called Rise and Shine by Katie Sullivan Morford, and she knows what she's doing. She's a registered dietitian, I believe, as well, and she had to deal with three children in the morning, and she wanted healthy breakfast. Well, listen to her, because she's going to tell you how you can rescue your day for breakfast. As I explained to Katie Sullivan Morford, when I saw the title, Rise and Shine, and realized it was a book about breakfast, I thought, oh no, this may be a real yawn, because I'm not a breakfast person. But it turns out that Katie has the same idea of breakfast that I have, is that it's not all the sweet garbage. In fact, one of the things I like very much, Katie, and I want to add that you're a registered dietitian as well as a chef. You have a master's degree in nutrition from NYU, and you've written other books that have been really well received and received awards on them, and you write for a number of publications. But one of the things I really liked about this, I mean, your premise is that, I mean, American breakfasts are pretty boring. I can tell you that much because I have two grandchildren. And it's always a, you know, I've run into the problems you mentioned, like I'm not hungry or I don't have time or, you know, that kind of thing. And it's easy to throw cereal at them. You know, that's the easiest thing. But you show how, with a little planning, you can actually make breakfast an interesting and nutritional meal, fueling them for the day. I loved the part that you had, because people are going to say, why worry about it? But you had this little chart, if I could find it. Here it is. Remodel your breakfast. Mm-hmm. Showing little ways that you could gradually change your morning eating habits. Tell me about this.
Well, I think that you're right. You know, the typical American breakfast can skew really sweet, and the default tends to come from a box of cereal. And my personal feeling is it can be so much more delicious, more nourishing, more interesting than that without a whole lot of work. And so I showed this remodel your breakfast as an example to say, for example, take something as simple as a container of strawberry yogurt, and how can you make that so much more interesting and nourishing? Building on that by using instead maybe plain Greek yogurt with fresh strawberries and, you know, either a delicious homemade granola or even a store-bought granola. With that, you're going to be getting more protein, less refined sugar, more nutrients, and more fiber. Again, another typical American breakfast, a plain bagel with cream. You know, a remodel of that would be to get a half of a whole grain bagel, put some beautiful avocado on that and some sliced egg, a little pinch of salt. And it's much more filling, nourishing, delicious, more protein, more fiber, more vitamin E, more iron, more interesting, more colorful. So I kind of go through some examples to just say, take a fresh look at what you're doing, and with a few little tweaks, you can have something very different.
Yeah, you have like a little guide to how you can accomplish this yourself. As I said, I have these two grandchildren, and I know what it's like getting their parents out to their jobs and the kids all off to school and the lunches packed and, you know, the whole thing. And it's daunting, and I will admit that one of the regrets I have from raising our son is that I was so overwhelmed not being a morning person anyhow that I let him get in the habit of eating the horrible instant oatmeal with all the refined sugar in it because he could do it himself.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, and that's sort of who I wrote this book for is all, you know, we're all so busy and the morning particularly can be crazy. I have three kids. So I thought very carefully about, you know, I really felt like this book is a book of solutions, to the challenge of breakfast. And, you know, one of the solutions is to try and find things that are really quick to make. When my middle daughter started high school, she was suddenly having to catch the bus almost 45 minutes earlier than she had the year prior. And the thing that was getting the shaft was breakfast. And so I came up with a bunch of ideas, many of which ended up in the book for her, that you know, initially I would make and then she learned to make. And one of them is a recipe that we all love in our house. I call it almost instant chocolate breakfast drink.
Oh, and it's, yes.
Yeah, it's basically my take on Carnation instant breakfast, but it's made with milk and nut butter and cocoa powder and a little bit of honey and ice, and you just throw all that in the blender and whirl it up, and you have a breakfast that has all, you know, hits all the buttons of nutrition, creamy, delicious. You can put it in a to-go cup, and it takes less than a minute to make. So I really tried to find solutions and be really realistic about how much time parents have, which isn't a lot.
Now, what was the acceptance process for the drink that had spinach in it?
Well, I noticed
that one too.
They mean the green smoothie even kids will love?
That's the one.
Yeah, that one, I have to say, you have to try it because it is delicious. It is really, really delicious, and my kids all love it. And, you know, my kids are not, I mean, they've sort of been weaned on all of these foods, but the real telltale is I made it one morning when a bunch of their friends slept over, and it was sort of hands down, everybody really went for it, and I thought, well, then I can call it even a smoothie even kids will love. And, with the pineapple and the whole orange and the banana,
yes,
that whole cup of spinach sort of just blends right in there, and you don't get that super spinachy flavor. It's a popular one in our house.
You know, I liked your comments on soft-cooked eggs. Our son gets in such a tizzy because I always eat soft-boiled eggs for breakfast if I don't have leftovers. And usually on Peter makes a mix of lentils and, sprouted quinoa.
Sprouted quinoa. I can't get, there was another sprouted mung beans, but I can't get sprouted mung beans at Whole Foods anymore.
Oh, dear.
That sounds delicious.
So I had to change it for quinoa.
But, of course, the grandchildren always wanted to have what Nana was having. And he is so touchy about not fully cooked eggs, and about salmonella and all that. And I said, you know, but Adam, you were raised on soft-boiled eggs for breakfast. And he said, but it's different now. And you mentioned that.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, I think the rates of salmonella are different now than when, say, I was growing up. And I think a lot of parents with young children are, you know, worry about that. Luckily, you can get pasteurized eggs and serve them perfectly safe to young children if that's something that you worry about. I know some people feel very comfortable giving their kids soft eggs, particularly if they're buying, you know, little local pastured eggs from a farmer's market or something. But I think parents, if that worries them, then I think there's an option, and there's just nothing like that soft yolk.
Yeah, I think so too. And I was very pleased that you served it with buttered soldiers.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to interrupt there because soldiers are really made with bread, not with toast.
Yeah, that's true.
Oh,
toast
okay.
is American.
All right.
I'm getting corrected by.
An expert on eating boiled eggs with soldiers
exactly.
for breakfast.
Exactly. I didn't know that. I'm learning something.
Yeah, you get a slice of bread and you butter it. Sadly, during the years immediately after World War II, we had margarine instead of butter. but it's still bread, not toast.
Okay. I stand corrected.
Yeah,
but this is America after all. So,
yes.
So we can do as we please.
Well, I learned something also. You said that actually, because I'm a big Greek yogurt fan, plain, not with fruit in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I like your idea of letting them add fruit, because I never buy the stuff with the fruit in it. But you said that Greek yogurt has less calcium.
Yes, it's interesting. So Greek yogurt, the strained yogurt, it has about double the protein of, you know, conventional yogurt, but it has less calcium. So it's sort
odd.
Of trade-offs.
Yeah, you'd think that looking at it, that it would be more, actually.
Yeah, I think the straining off of that, the whey, there's a loss of some of the calcium there, but then everything else is more concentrated.
Uh-huh.
And one recipe, you know, that, because I'm not a big fan of pre-sweetened yogurt either, but one of my absolute favorite recipes in the book, in the yogurt chapter, is honey-stewed summer fruit.
Uh-huh.
And, I mean, I know we're coming to the very, very tail end of the stone fruits, but it's sort of slow-cooked peaches or nectarines or plums with a little bit of honey, and you spoon that still warm over Greek yogurt, and it's just heaven. It's so good.
Well, I think that a nice take on breakfast is presented in your section on sandwiches and wraps for
mm-hmm.
breakfast,
because mm-hmm.
that's everything you need.
Yeah.
Our family had a recipe, which I have not made, because we don't eat a whole lot of bread since we're just ourselves now, but my mother used to make it. It's a spinach bread, which comes from Sicily, and it's two kinds of cheeses, one of them being Parmesan and the other whatever cheese, with originally it was Swiss chard, but we ended up with spinach a lot of times, and an Italian loaf of bread. So
mm-hmm.
you've got everything, and it's one slice of that, and you had a whole meal.
Right.
And you could make that and put it in the refrigerator, and I've done that many a times.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, I have a chapter on quick breads and muffins, and there's a savory zucchini bread. It's a cheesy zucchini and olive bread.
Uh-huh.
And it's, you know, I'm not familiar with the Italian bread you're talking about, but it's got a lot of zucchini, and it's made with whole grain flour and chunks of cheddar and you know, savory olives, and it's really satisfying. And same kind of idea, you know, have a slice of that with a glass of milk or a cup of tea for the grown-ups, and it'll fortify you.
Right. Well, you have so many interesting. What ones were you fascinated by, Rob? About lemon blueberry polenta muffins or slow cooker cinnamon toast would work. Our kids use a slow cooker for everything.
I liked what Katie said about egg white omelets.
What did she say?
She said they're essentially, to net it out, they're a work of the devil.
Yes, I think
the best,
so.
The best part of the eggs are the yolks, and why you would not
it's
want
true.
Them, I have no idea.
Well, because it was this hot protein, no carb kind of thing, for no fat for a while. But, yeah, and all the bodybuilders were eating egg white almost. So
yeah,
I started.
I'm a fan of the yolk. I really am.
I used to actually, as a child on Easter, my friends didn't like the yolk, and I would trade them. I'd get the yolks, and I'd give them my whites.
Oh, that's kind of cute.
Smart, Alika.
Yeah. Anyhow, you give tips on how to accomplish this, and I think that even the person producing these breakfasts will have to sort of roll into it gently, because, I mean, if you're not really alert at 6:30 in the morning, it could be a problem.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I, you know, talk about is that I think, you know, folks maybe on a weekend will think about their meal plan for the week. You know, we've got five dinners coming up, you know, make the shopping list, go to the market. And oftentimes the breakfast part of the equation is just an afterthought. And I just encourage people to just bring a little thought to the meal planning around breakfast. And it doesn't have to be a lot of ingredients or a laundry list, but just a tiny bit of consciousness around, okay, what are the mornings going to look like, I think can make all the difference. And even just a handful, I have an example of this in the book where you can just take a handful of sort of ingredients and turn them into five very different meals. And, you know, it doesn't need to be super complicated. It just requires a little bit of forethought.
And of course, a copy of the book.
And yes, of course, that helps. I try to, like, with my kids, I'll pull the book out on a weekend and say, let's pick a few that we're going to do this week, and then fill in with other things. And so we'll flip through it and pick two or three, and maybe some of those things I make on the weekend, and then the other ones are just really the quick ones that you can throw together while you're making your coffee.
Right. So, again, the author is Katie Sullivan Morford, and the book is called Rise and Shine. And this lady knows food, and she also knows children. I was very impressed with that.
Yeah, so, Katie, we wish you lived closer so we could come by for breakfast any day.
Oh, I wish so, too.
Well, I wish you lots of luck with this book because it's really a worthwhile book.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Thank you.
And you better get to the dogfight.
I can hear him. Sorry about that.
It's okay.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, our next book is, I could just picture whoever thought of the title of this book doing so with considerable glee. It's called A Colander Cake Stand and My Grandfather's Iron Skillet.
Why don't we just let the author explain what it's all about?
It's not the author, it's the editor, Aaron Byers Murray, with a foreword by one of my most favorite people, is J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. But you get a combination of recipes, kitchen equipment, nostalgia, and also all the contributions from these celebrity chefs, all edited by Aaron Byers Murray. Really enjoyed this book thoroughly, Aaron Byers Murray. It's called A Colander Cake Stand and My Grandfather's Iron Skillet. And in it, you ask 37 different chefs what their most treasured kitchen tools are. And how did this go about? First of all, how did you select 37 and why 37 chefs?
Oh, 37 was the magic number. Uh-huh. I started this project really because in speaking with my editor, we talked about, he's actually a woodworker. So he had been working on a project that involved woodworkers and their tools. And, it was going to be similar in scope in that the woodworker would talk in depth about the tool and then offer some tips about how to use it. And I'm a food writer, and coming from that background, knowing chefs and knowing the kitchen, I was so intrigued by this idea of what story a tool can tell.
Oh, yeah.
And in the kitchen especially. And I think it just made sense to really to tell a chef's story through the tool that they use, the tool that they consider their go-to or most treasured item. And so we started putting together a list, and I've been lucky enough to work with a lot of chefs over the years, and I've, you know, put out asks to a number of the ones that I already knew or that I had a friendship with, and that was kind of the catalyst, and the list grew and grew, and I think eventually we had to put a cap on it, but yeah, 37 ended up being the magic number.
Now, you said that were you talking about, who's Carpenter?
Oh, my editor, actually, at Springhouse Press, which is a new publisher, newish publisher.
Yeah, I'd like to know the story of Springhouse Press, because it's unusual to get a new independent publisher in the
city. Yes, and these two guys are really forging a new path, I think. But they did start out with a small collection of woodworking books that they, you know, the editor is a woodworker, but they've, you know, and he actually worked at a woodworking publication at one point, but that was a very, it made sense, I think, as a topic for them, but they wanted to quickly grow into a bigger realm, and cookbooks, they do crafting books, I think they're working on some other narrative pieces, they've done a cocktail book, so it's young and growing, and I encourage especially authors out there to seek them out.
Oh, yes.
Now, do they know the microplane story? They ought to know the microplane story, so make a note and be sure to let them know.
Because I will.
you know the microplanes are absolutely fabulous, and they're always coming up with new ideas.
Yeah.
But the very first microplane to be used with food was actually a carpenter's tool.
I've read that, actually, yes.
You know it already. It was
that's actually one of the stories in the book, although he doesn't talk about that, the origin.
Yeah,
of,
I know. I don't remember which chef had a microplane, but I was surprised that he didn't know about it until whenever he said.
When he discovered it, he was at a chef demo, and the chef before him was a pastry chef, and this was before Martha Stewart, you know, made them a very big deal. This was before they had the plastic handles in the cooking world, but it had been used as a cooking tool. But
he saw somebody
using an old school microplane, and I think it was nutmeg or cinnamon that they were shaving over a dessert. And he thought, I've got to find that. And it took him a while. He couldn't even find it on the internet at that point. So this was back then.
The story the microplane people told us is that this particular—I don't think she was a chef. I think she just was
a chef's wife.
She was a home cook.
Mm.
And he was a carpenter, and she was frustrated over the difficulty of grating something. I don't know what.
Okay.
And regular graters that she bought wouldn't work.
So in desperation, she
raided her husband's carpenter's tool chest and extracted what a carpenter would call a rasp, R-A-S-P, and what. Today is a microplane grater, started out as a carpenter's rasp. And that's the story.
Yeah. That's a good one.
It is a good one.
I thought you might like it. It took me a while to get it in the conversation.
Anyhow, so we have our 37 chefs, and the whole point is that they are really describing their own characters when they're describing what they like about these favorite tools, right?
That was my observation. I don't know if they would admit to that, but I found that, you know, they sort of used this language that was personal and very, you know, it was delving deeper into just, this is my favorite knife, and I use it to cut this. You know, one of my favorite stories is about a chef up in Milwaukee. Zachary Espinosa talks about his plating spoon.
Oh, yeah.
And when he was first starting out, he had gone to Goodwill to fill his knife kit because he was a young chef. He had no money, and, you know, he needed to get a certain number of spoons and knives. And he found this spoon, and it was a larger than a soup spoon, but he kind of got it in his bag, and he's always used it as his plating spoon, and it's got this funny bend in the handle, and it's because he would keep it in his bain-marie in the water bin in front of him, and pull it out when he was ready to plate and shake the water off, and then he would bang it very hard against the side of the metal table to get the rest of the water off, to really get it dry. And that sound also signaled to all the other chefs on the line that he was about to go up with his dish. But the spoon has developed this great nickname called TJ Hooker. but what I loved was how he just said, you know, it was the spoon and I are one and the same. It's a humble, it's unexpectedly sturdy, it is, you know, it will never disappoint me. And he said, and that's me. I'm one of those cooks that, you know, you might underestimate me by looking at me, but, you know, I'm reliable and I'm always going to show up and I'm always going to do my job. And it was just, it just kind of hit home that, you know, a lot of these things are so personal that they sort of become a part of us. And so I really enjoyed that story. And as I kept interviewing chefs and talking to them, I could hear little snippets of that as they described their tool. It sounded as though they were, in a way, describing themselves.
Well, Chris, what I got is, I mean, so many of them have a connection to the person or place where they got it.
Mm-hmm.
And that was why it was so treasured.
For some of them, yes. I think for some of them, especially the family stories.
Yeah, like Alon Shaya with his mortar and pestle.
His mortar and pistol.
somebody
asked him what it was. And
that was another favorite.
TSA was not amused, I guess.
Coming over from the Middle East, no, I would imagine they were not. So, but it made it over, and now it's in his possession. So
he's another one of our favorites. We've interviewed so many of these chefs that are in the book. It's interesting.
Good.
I didn't quite understand Bruce Sherman's coconut bench scraper. I mean, I keep looking at the diagram of it, and I still don't get it. It doesn't look like a bench scraper to me.
Well, it's an, you know, the name of it I was confused by too, but I think that's what it goes by over in India. But really, it's a tool that, and I've never seen these in person. He shared a picture of his actual one, but it you cut the coconut in half and you sort of scrape out the insides, and the tool has a sort of cup in it, and the meat from the coconut and the milk from the coconut both get collected in this bowl.
I've never seen anything like it, and boy, I think if it worked, it would be handy, because that's a
tedious
job.
Okay, so it's called a bench scraper, but it's actually a coconut out of the shell scraper.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. That would be my name for it.
It seems to be kind of a misnomer, huh?
Yeah, now the cast iron pots, I think, is something everybody can relate to, the cast iron skillets. I have all of my grandmothers still using it. And in fact, I got a modern one that somebody sent me that we were interviewing from a prominent maker.
Lunch.
Yeah, I wasn't going to say it. Yeah. But I'm glad you.
No, I mean it's a great. They make really good ones.
Well,
but we gave it away. we're so generous. We gave it to our son and daughter-in-law.
Oh wow!
Now I can't say what I was about to say.
Yes, you can.
I was about to say that my grandmothers were made better, even though these are pre-conditioned or whatever you call them.
I think it was Lytton Hopkins talks about his grandfather's Griswold skillet, which he still has.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I think there are, you know, I'm glad that they're still making them and that cast iron is kind of having this resurgence right now. Lodge is expanding even, you know. I mean, that's a pretty good story, success story, so.
Yes, it is. I mean, any chef would really feel he or she needed a cast iron skillet now. And I think the things that
we've seen kitchens where they have dozens of them.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, we have dozens of them.
Yeah, we have a few too. But they're constantly recycling. They must have 100 little cast iron pans in service at the same time. And they cook one little dish in it and then they put it on one side and somebody of an inferior rank comes along and picks them all up and gets the job of cleaning cast iron skillets all day long.
Now tell me this, from Andrew Zimmern's Conical Steamer, what does that tell you about Andrew Zimmern?
Well, I liked what he had to say in his story. You know, he was really sort of expounding on this point that here in the U.S. and maybe just in, I would say in North America, his argument is that rice is such a big part of so many other cultural cuisines. and it, that it crosses all these cultural lines and country lines and borders, talking about how the Chinese use it, how the Burmese use it, how Cambodia use it. But, you know, and it's sort of saying, like, the American kitchen needs to have a version of this, you know. And I think that speaks to his bigger interest, which is in introducing people to cuisines and, you know, crossing those cultural barriers as well, introducing people to new foods and also to new cultures. So
That's what it's all about, I know.
Yeah.
Now, Jeremy Seawall, that was another one. I mean, did the handles fall off of this colander and then it was laced with string or rope? Or?
Yeah. Well, this was his grandmother's, and she used to garden. I have a big, big garden in Maine, and it was a big part of their, you know, childhood summers was being at that house in Maine and watching her pull vegetables in from the garden. And she carried that colander out to the garden with her, and I think the handles, just after years and years, had just come off. Mm-hmm. So the ropes, and, you know, he didn't really have a reason for why they used those ropes, but those ropes have been on there, I think, since his grandmother gave him this colander. So now he uses it when he's picking tomatoes with his sons and daughter in his own garden. And I think for him it's that, you know, even a piece of equipment like that, like he would never go out and buy a new one.
No, he's not sure even how it ever got that way, he said.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
That's like buying salmon skin sheet.
Yes.
We could probably afford another baking tray. And the latest,
it's really cheap aluminum. The latest
stain is really quite remarkable. It looks like an oil painting. Because
how did you decide that that was the right tool?
I don't know. He just checked it.
It's just the perfect size. It's flat. It doesn't have sides going up to get in the way. Mm-hmm. So you can just pop the salmon skin, you just peel it off the salmon, and then you put it on the tray, and then you wait until the salmon is fully cooked and everything else is on the table. And then with the broiler turned off, or with the oven turned off, depending on which, you just put the sheet in with the skin on it, and 10 minutes later, it's absolutely perfect.
Except you can't clean the...
And if you leave it in there till tomorrow,
which we started,
it's still, the skin's still edible, but the mark that's on there now is because I forgot to turn the broiler off. So the skin got another 4 or 5 hours of cooking time, and that stain, if you can call it that, I don't know what you would call it really, that deposit is never coming off. I tried everything. It's never coming off.
It's made its mark.
Yeah. Now, some of these chefs have found things in flea markets, and that's interesting. And they're not just family mementos, but like Timothy Hollingsworth with these fluted scoops. What were these scoops used for?
You know, he wasn't even sure. I think it was really for these, you know, beautiful either hors d'oeuvre or appetizer plates, but it would be for fruits or creams or butters. So it was in France, they were used as sort of this really fine dining decorative piece of a plate. And so obviously he saw them and thought, this is, you know, he just loved the idea of what they could create, and that they were so unique. Each one was a different shape and a different size, and I think that's what he was drawn to with that. So,
I have a feeling that you started something here that people are going to catch on to.
Yeah.
And they're going to have their own family collection.
Now, what's the heirlooms, thing that rather...
Just like the ones we've been referring to.
Daniel Boulou's place, DB, whatever it is.
DBB.
What does he have? Pots by chefs on the wall.
Oh yes, yeah. He persuaded a chef to give him their old pots.
Yeah.
So that he could decorate the wall. It's not.
Have you never been there?
It's DBGB. It's not DB Bistro Moderne. It's DBGB. It's the one that's down on the Bowery.
Oh, okay.
So one wall at least.
He's all cooking pots.
I haven't seen it.
I think he has some dangling from the ceiling too.
Yeah, I mean, the chefs have given them their, and they're identified as sort of like a chef's pot graveyard. So, but anyhow, I just think it's a fascinating book. You did a wonderful job with it. And, I mean, there are a few knives in it, but it was interesting to see the chefs talk about something besides their favorite knife.
Well, we were laughing when we first came up with this list because I said we kind of need to find a way to keep them from talking about knives because we know that they turn to their knives first, usually. So originally my thought was everything but the knife or, you know, something to kind of say this is not about knives. But then, of course, when we did have a few chefs who submitted knives for their stories, I thought we've got to allow knives, at least one or two.
Yeah. Well, as I said, great job, Erin Byers Murray.
Thank you.
It's called A Colander, Cake Stand, and My Grandfather's Iron Skillet. Great job. Thank you for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
And a pistol too, right?
A mortar and pistol too.
As well as enjoying today's program, I hope you had a great Thanksgiving earlier in the week. We certainly did, and we hope you'll join us again, same time, same place next week. Isn't that what we usually say?
Yes.
And what do we usually say now?
Bye-bye.